Good morning, members and good morning, Chair. My name is Olivia Kamege. I'm working to support for defense and out of the country. And the members will introduce themselves, starting from my right.
Thank you, Doc. My name is Lieutenant General Ngeni. I am the Chief UN Resources Department of Defense. Thank you. Honorable Chair, honorable members, I'm Major General Denise Tibet, the Chief Director, Human Resources Strategic Direction, Policy and Plans.
Good morning, Chair President. I'm the Brigadier General Chisho Hai, Director, Human Resources Services.
Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Major General Raman Sana, Chief Military Policy Strategy and Planning.
Morning, my name is Rajima Remy, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer for TOG.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Vincent Zaza. I am currently the head of the Secretary to the NPC.
I think we have Mr. Tassier. Can you introduce yourself? You want to talk into that microphone.
Good morning, I'm not from my partner, the city director, community director.
Thank you very much. Let's get straight to
Honorable Chair, my name is Guy Lam. I'm Director of the Second Violence Mission at the University of Kent.
Thank you so much. Then let's get straight to our agenda.
Chair, excuse me, I'd like to introduce the new director in Conventional Arms Control.
You said because there was an introduction, I need to say that in about 2006, the General Assembly of the United Nations adopted a resolution, which resolution therefore launched a series of negotiations by the UN with all the member states, with the aim of trying therefore to establish a treaty that would regulate the arms transfers across the world. But such negotiations therefore culminated in 2013, April, when there was an adoption of this particular treaty, which therefore subsequently opened for signature in June 2015. South Africa, as you would understand, was part of the process, and I and others, colleagues from government, were party to this particular process. But in July 2013, therefore, after such adoption of the ATT, we therefore sought the approval of cabinet of South Africa to sign the treaty. And secondly, we asked cabinet to give us a go-ahead to introduce this particular treaty to Parliament for ratification. Quick approvals, therefore, we were given. And in September 2013, therefore, the President, during the General Assembly meeting, therefore signed the treaty on behalf of the country. And by way of just indicating what this ATT is, it's an arms treaty. What it is an arms, it is a legally binding instrument that sets basic minimum standards for the regulation of international trade in conventional arms. And the intention behind that is to ensure that there is indeed a prevention of diversion of these kind of weapons to the illicit market because of the negative consequences that therefore arise if these weapons are in the wrong hands. But the ATT therefore has adopted and with all its objects seeks therefore to form part of international law. And I think the committee would be aware that international law therefore is part of law which generally regulates the relations between states. So this ATT therefore is positioned at that particular level. In terms of the relevant provisions of this particular treaty, basically says Article 22 of that. It talks about the treaty having to come into force once 90 days after the 50th member of the ATT has ratified. It says the treaty will not kick into force until the 50 members who have signed and ratified. The current indication that we have therefore is that at this point in time, there are 53 countries who have ratified. And by implication, therefore, it means the treaty is in force at that particular level. However, then South Africa, if South Africa ratifies Parliament, if Parliament ratifies the treaty, therefore South Africa will become therefore one of those countries that will probably be in the 54th or 55th nation to be a member of the ATT. However, then in terms of again the provision of this particular treaty, once you ratify the treaty, it takes about 3 months or 90 days for it to kick into force in your own jurisdiction. So it says that if South Africa ratifies today, there will be 3 months to go past, after which therefore the treaty will be in full effect. In terms of the numbers that we have currently, if there are 53 member states, it is estimated therefore that by the 24th of December this treaty will kick into force, and South Africa therefore if it's part of that, they have to calculate three months after that. Therefore, I think we have to understand the issue of agreements, potential agreements, in the context of the provisions of the Constitution. And Article 21 of the treaty basically recognizes that the different countries have got different legal systems. But what is key amongst all these particular systems is that they either ratify treaties or they accept them or they do them through an approval process. But in the context of these countries in South Africa, if you look at section 231 of 2 of the Constitution, it says any treaty would only become effective in this country and become binding once Parliament has ratified that. And therefore it recognizes that there are two houses in Parliament, and both houses therefore have got to support this, and therefore there shall be a resolution that is taken to bring about the ratification. However, then section 234 of the Constitution, therefore, section 2314 of the Constitution, therefore, talks about how, therefore, international agreements or conventions And they do so in terms of this provision of the Constitution through domestication, which basically says that you're required to have a domestic legislation that would provide a basis for such a provisions of the convention to be effective in a particular jurisdiction. So what we are therefore looking for in Parliament is support or is a ratification of the treaty so that it can therefore be binding in South Africa, because we believe that the provisions of this particular treaty would be of good effect to South Africa. And those are the countries that we are doing business with in terms of arms trade. Our position during the arms trade treaty chair negotiations, as indicated, was informed by various considerations, and amongst others are the following. We have therefore understood and appreciated the provision of the Constitution and their requirements to ourselves, as well as the implications in terms of how you apply those particular conventions on adoption. But the second one was South African government has got an interest in the establishment of common minimum international standards for arms transfer. And this interest is basically driven by the requirements, not the requirements, but the understanding that if you are doing arms trade, you largely deal with other countries. You sell arms beyond the jurisdiction. And it becomes very, very key, therefore, that in such a situation, the countries that you trade with are also of the same understanding of the rules of the game. And I think, therefore, our consideration and support for the ACT was, amongst others, pushed by that particular sector. But the other point that we have as a consideration was the concern about illicit trade in arms, because we therefore understand that if arms therefore get into the wrong hands, there are negative consequences that arise. And if they do arise, therefore, there are always human security problems, as well as that there are risks to international peace, and therefore, we felt that the ACT would therefore work towards the prevention of such situations from arising. But the other one is about our understanding, if you're running the defense industry, or if you're a member of the defense industry, or if you're a member of government, having some association with the business of arms trade, would understand it. One day the treaty of this kind is enforced, it brings about certain obligations and implications. And those, therefore, we have appreciated, and I think we understand quite it. So those were considerations that we took into account as we negotiated. But last year, the issue of our state capacity to execute arising obligations, it's a directive by government that before we can subscribe to any international treaty, we must make an appreciation of the capacity of the state to implement the obligations that are arising out of that. And we have done such an assessment over here, and I will therefore lay in the presentation indicate how we intend to deal with such considerations. We therefore sought the state law advisor's advice on this matter, whether this treaty was consistent with the provisions of the Constitution and other body of law of South Africa. And the confirmation that we received therefore was positive. And obviously then the signing of the treaty was informed by those kind of things. And obviously Parliament was therefore were directed to Parliament to seek ratification as required by law. What happened, Chair, after the ratification process, because that question may arise, once we have obtained ratification by Parliament, there are various steps that we need to take. One of them is basically to ensure that we place before the depository of the United Nations, who is the SG of the United Nations, our instrument of ratification. And we do that through GCOP, which is the department that handles that access. And once we have done that, therefore the treaty kicks into force, obviously, 90 days after such a depositing of the instrument. But the third aspect, therefore, is that we need to develop, if we have to go by the provision, if we have to just, for a second, go by the provisions of 231 of the Constitution, we are supposed to bring about an enabling legislation. But I'm going to explain how we think this particular provision is would not necessarily arise in this particular instance. What is the position with the view of trying to deal with the question of enabling legislation? We have therefore conducted an analysis. And the analysis of our legal framework, we basically had to answer two questions. One question was whether there is present in a South African context a legal framework relevant to arms trade. That was the first question. And the second question that I answered was, in the event where such a framework exists, Therefore, how can we create safeguards to ensure that those provisions are effectively given expression? And the analysis therefore indicated that there is a legislation that we think is present and adequate to deal with the provisions of the ACC, and that legislation is the National Convention on Control Act of 2002, as amended in 2008. However, to the extent of small arms, and I'll explain how the small arms come into play with it, and to the extent of the small arms, therefore, the NCC actually complemented by the Firearms Control Act, which is basically administered by the FATF. And I think Chair and Committee members are aware therefore that the NCC actually is therefore administered by the National Convention on Control Committee, which is therefore chaired currently by Minister Hadele with about nine cabinet ministers who are members of that. So we felt therefore that the analysis indicates that there's legislation inadequate to deal with this obligation. And obviously then, in terms of execution of the obligation, therefore the NCC is with all its structures will be responsible for such work. But our view, the question is that if we were to attend to all these matters, get the certification from Parliament, and be able, therefore, to deal with the provisions of the treaty through the NCAC Act and the Firearms Control Act, we would have, therefore, satisfied our obligations under the Convention, which is what we basically stand for. Chair, in the next few slides, I'll be dealing, therefore, with the ACC itself. Now that we've spoken about the context around that, is to deal now with what I would consider to be some signing features of the ACC. And as I said, Chair, that our assessment tells us that the current legal framework in South Africa of arms control is of a higher standard than that standard which is advocated by the ACC, and I think therefore in the next few slides I will seek therefore to prove that statement. Insofar as therefore as Article 1 of the Convention, there's various articles in the Convention or the ACC as it is, but Article 1 of that talks about the object and purpose of the treaty, and it sets out that and it says the object of this particular treaty, which is the ACC, is that of establishing the highest possible common international standards for regulating arms transfer. And by so doing, therefore, eradicate illicit trade and diversion of arms. But once we therefore set up such an object, therefore the temple therefore will fit into basically promoting international peace and security, preventing human suffering, as well as promoting states' responsibility, cooperation, and transparency. Because we have therefore learned over years of practice that the state's responsibility in arms trade is very key. The issue of cooperation between member states is very key. Much as it is very key to have a very transparent measure, either through reporting, either by other engagements that would be relevant at any given point in time. But the responsibility of the state is very key here. And we are of the view, therefore, that the ACC, as set out in the object of Article 1, would be able, therefore, to fit towards that. And these are the values, Chair, that we stand for as the NCAC, which is the committee that I represent, and government as a whole. But with regards to Article 2 of the Convention, Article 2, therefore, sets out the scope within which, therefore, the ACC applies. It covers a certain kind of because any treaty would therefore direct itself towards a particular set of people in the area of summit. And I think this one therefore specifically shared, therefore deals with this kind of weapons, deals with vessel tanks, deals with armored combat vehicles, large caliber artillery systems, combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, missile launchers, and small arms and light vehicles. So it therefore means that any transfer or any export or importation of this kind of controlled items, these items therefore are subject of the ACC. And by implication, if you therefore ratify that, will therefore be subject of your domestic legislation to deal with the issue of transfer. But insofar as those categories of weapons are concerned, therefore there are certain activities that the treaty deals with. One of it deals with export, import, transit, transshipment, and brokering. So it therefore means that if you are to ratify, your legislation should demonstrate that it deals with the activities in terms of export, import, transit, transshipment, and brokering in the first instance. And secondly, it must only be focused on those particular categories of the treaty as indicated. As said, the project, this provides for 7 United Nations Register of Commercial Arms categories. And I think I am glad to say that part of the people who are here today are some of our members from civil society who are part of the negotiation process. And will therefore be familiar with the discussions and terminology that was used during that particular period. One of it was, we're talking about 7 categories plus 2, because we're saying there are 7 categories of the UN register plus 2, which is for small arms and light vehicles. But what the ATT, the purchase, does not have, and I think I need to make this point very clear, is that it does not therefore apply to the international movement of conventional arms on behalf of or by the state, as long as those particular arms remain in the country, not in the country, remain in under the ownership of a state party. In simple terms, therefore, it says if South Africa is to deploy certain equipment to the DRC, insofar as the provisions of the ATT, such weapons remain those of the SANDF. They don't change ownership, and therefore the provisions of the ACC may not be applicable to that. And therefore, we are saying these categories here, as well as the activities set out in the first bullet of this presentation, are adequately covered by the NCACS. The NCACS deals with, amongst others, conventional arms, dual use goods and technologies. And the categories that are indicated in terms of battery tanks, armored combat vehicles, and missiles are subject of the law as it is at the present moment. But to the extent, therefore, of small arms, because small arms are not falling under the NCACS, because they fall under the Firearms Control Registry, which is therefore established pursuant to the provisions of the Firearms Control Act, and that is administered by the NCACS. And therefore, any transfer of small arms may be your 9mm that you may be familiar with. So those would be subject to the rules of our transfer that set out under that transfer legislation. But as a country, therefore, we're saying the two legislations are complementary in ensuring that the provisions of the ATT, as a country, we are able to deal with them. And the other one, Chair, I'm deliberately omitting certain aspects like Article 3, 4, and because those are not as important as Article 5, which I think I'm going to speak to in a moment. That Article 5, therefore, says each and every state party, which South Africa would be once it's ratified, you are supposed to establish and maintain a national control system that would have control, a national control list that would implement the provisions of the Act. And therefore, we think, in the South African context, our assessment of the tells us that we already have a national control system, and that is why I say we have introduced ourselves as officials who are therefore working for that particular control system. And we've got the national control list. The NCACS, with its attendant regulations, constitute such a control list. And I think members of the committee will therefore be aware of that. Further, Article 5, because we shall therefore establish and designate a national authority to handle this particular responsibility. And in our instance, therefore, we say to the NCACS, the National Conventional Arms Control Committee, as the tribe area, therefore constitute such a national authority, which therefore exercises effective and transparent control of arms transfers in South Africa. So, Chair, the point I'm demonstrating is the provisions of the ATT are there, but we already have got systems in place in South Africa that are currently running, which are then therefore going to be used to give expression to those particular provisions. The other one, Chair, is about the prohibition, Article 6, basically. It sets out grounds on which you should consider not to export arms, as it were. It therefore says that it places prohibition. It says, as a part in the event where you realize that any transfer of arms would bring about some trouble in the country of destination, you may not do so. And therefore, those prohibitions that are in place are amongst that of the following. Where there's UN arms embargoes, you may not sell. And where there is a likelihood of the commission of genocide, where there are crimes against humanity, where there are great breaches of the Geneva Convention, where there are attacks against civilians, as well as where there are just other crimes that's defined in other conventions. So Chairman, who was saying we take note of the prohibitions that set out in Article 6 of that, and we are saying in a context of South Africa, if we look at the NCCS, particularly Section 15 of that, it sets out what is called the guiding principles and criteria for unfairness or unsanctioned. You are therefore to consider these factors before you can decide on whether to sell or not to sell. So these provisions therefore of the ECC are already adequately covered in a context of South Africa. Chair, therefore, in a summarized question, risk assessment and mitigation, Article 7, 8, 9, and 11 speak largely about import, export, brokering, and as well as transfers. But all that it says is that before you can therefore allow such activities to be carried out, there is an assessment that we have to do. There are certain factors we have to take into account before you can decide whether to export or not. And it says there, in considering a possible arms transfer, states are required to conduct a thorough risk assessment and determine an appropriate mitigation. Because at some point, as you do your risk assessment or your assessment, as you said, before you even talk about risk assessment, but assessment, you will therefore identify a possible risk. And if that risk, therefore, you can mitigate, you can put up some mitigation action. But if such a risk, therefore, is overriding, you may therefore not authorize such an arms transfer. And therefore, in a context of South Africa, how do we deal with that? We already do so. These are the assessments and mitigations that are dealt with already under the provisions of Section 15 of the Act, which therefore, after consideration, you can come in either of these positions. You can approve if you realize that there is no risk. You can hold when you are still doing your risk assessment and you are still watching whether there will be improvement in the political situation. And thirdly, you can deny and say, we are not going to sell to country Z because of this particular risk. So, Chair, therefore, this exercise of approving, holding, and denying of applications for arms trade is currently a function carried out by the NCECC, and therefore I head the administration of that, and we therefore on many occasions approve or hold or deny. So these provisions are already dealt with. Article 13, which is I'm nearing the end, talks about the issue of reporting. It says, in terms of this article of the ECC, it says state parties are required to report on implementation measures. They are supposed to report at predetermined times on certain aspects. One of which, national legislation controls or to counter diversion. The submission of annual reports that are similar to the UN register report. And Chair, therefore, we are saying South Africa has got, at a certain moment, system already running dealing with this particular question. The NCHC provides reports to the UN at predetermined times on annual basis, covering the seven categories as defined under the relevant resolution establishing that particular register. And also, do we provide reports, Chair, as you would know, we on a quarterly basis provide reports to Parliament according to the format that's defined by the regulations as well as by the primary legislation itself. So we are saying, Chair, there's already mechanisms in place which are already running, which are established and they are currently operational towards this particular objective. Chair, therefore, in closing, the last slide that I have is about how we move forward. Given this presentation shared before, once Parliament has ratified this particular treaty, which are decision we called for, DECO will process our instrument of ratification right through to the United Nations as we go. And secondly, therefore, the treaty will come into force 90 days after such ratification or instrument of ratification has been deposited. And thirdly, therefore, we shall begin with the execution of all our treaty obligations. But Chair, therefore, we are not going to wait for the 90 days to come before we can do that. Because such obligations or such activities are already carried out. In fact, they were carried out long before even ACC was conceptualized. And moving forward, therefore, we shall form part of delegations that engage with other state parties in checking the state of operation of the treaty,
looking for probably areas of possible amendments and the like. And share, therefore, we are, as government, prepared therefore, to continue to engage with other member states who are members of the state of the ACC in ensuring that the future remains effective and improved as a government. But share, therefore, in summary, we are calling for the CCD to support the ratification of some of the chiefs by parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members.
Chair, we certainly support the treaty and the Electric Committee will dispense with this recording. Just a question of clarification. I understand that either the NCACC Act or the regulations to that Act will have to be amended. The amendment will be a minor amendment in order to provide for record keeping over a period of 10 years. Is that correct? And if it is correct, when would that amendment be brought to Parliament?
If I can respond to that, I think it is true that the act would require to be amended to the extent of the period of keeping records of funds transfers. Currently, legislation provides for 5 years. The ACC calls for 10 years. So we're going to move up to 10 years. And I think, Chair, the point in terms of convention, I think once ratification therefore has been effected here, I think the draft of the amendment is already on the table, but we're waiting for this process to run its course, after which then we shall introduce the amendment. Thank you.
Any answers? Thank you very much. If there's no more questions, Nancy, we will take this route. Your first is already on the board, that we will defer the adoption of the report to the next meeting where we will be forming a quorum. I think that will be tomorrow. We will support this as well. Thank you very much. We move to the next item in the agenda. The first human resource facility and improvement in conditions of service. Chairman Alex,
thank you, Chair. I'm a member of the committee. I'm not going to do the presentation myself. I'm going to ask Major General Andrew Kibet to do the presentation. As we've been instructed, we are coming here to give you an update on our DOD human resource strategy and improvement on conditions of service of our members since 2009.
Chairperson, honourable members, as the Chief of Human Resources indicated, the topic today, as we received it from this committee, is to present an update of the Department's Human Resource Strategy and where we stand with this, and then also what are those conditions and services that we implemented since 2009 to improve the benefits of soldiers. an update status on the process that we embarked on in implementing our overarching human resource strategy. And when we analyze the tasks, you specifically refer to the appropriate quantity, quality, composition, and cost, and the progress made in this regard, as well as the service benefits improvements. We will deal, therefore, with a short introduction, what is the quality dimension look like, the quantity dimension, the composition, the cost, the improvements, and then a few challenges also moving forward. As Chairperson, honorable members, the UD overarching human resource strategy was approved by the Chief of the SANDF and the Secretary as far back as 2009. But as it goes with each and every strategy, that overarching HR strategy gives the direction, but it's all about implementation. And then the department develops a very comprehensive Department of Defense Human Resource Charter, also nicknamed Cradle to Grave, to implement the overarching HR strategy and to guide that process. And that was also approved to the Military Command Council in February 2013. What's also important, Chairperson, honorable members, is that those aspects in the overarching HR strategy and Cradle to Grave or HR UD Charter is also aligned to a large extent with the Defense Review 2014 and the provisions contained in that Defense Review, and it's linked to the HR Charter and the overarching strategy. And therefore, its implementation over the short to medium term is an ongoing process that will unfold. Chairperson, in the overarching documents, there's a lot of talk about quantity and costs. In the defense review document, there are four milestones being set up. And you will see at the the end of August, we have just over 12,000 civilian members in the department, 22,000 reserves, and 65,709 regular members. In terms of the defense review, they foresee that in milestone one, there will be a decrease in the strength. That is not necessarily what will happen. There's still a process to unfold. Because when we look at the current commitments in terms of deployments, and specifically to the reduce from the current 65,000 in terms of regulars to the 47,000, is still a process that we will follow and debate it. And then obviously to milestone 2, 3, and 4, there's an increase, and that is a process that will be guided through the defense review process. So that's just a slide to say that is what it envisages in terms of the defense review, and we need to note that. Chairperson, if we look at the APEX profile of the new year overarching HR strategy, we started with the aim, and it talks about those empowerments in terms of composition and cost to execute the mandate and the mission of the department. Therefore, this strategy, as one of the support strategies for the military strategy, aimed towards mission-ready human resources. And to ensure that mission-ready human resources, the mission is to ensure well-managed mission-ready resources through the application of sound HR management practices. And the mission success factors to ensure that mission, you need to apply proper transformational leadership. You need to make sure that you are dedicated ownership of those objectives, 57 of them in this strategy, and see that the excellent communication takes place, and that we also report on progress and corrective interventions to execute this strategy. This strategy, Chairperson, is based on three pillars. The first pillar is, as I call it, theme one, is fit to the appropriate quantity, quality, composition, and cost. And in our brief, Chairperson, that is where our presentation will focus today in terms of what was required. But there's also a second theme that talked about excellent and accountable human resource administration and management. And obviously, theme three is alignment with broader government objectives at the end of the day. So, Chairperson, if we can look at theme one, one, and we develop a balanced scorecard methodology which is interlinked with appropriate defense capabilities. To ensure that appropriate defense capability, you need one of your most important strategic resources is human resources of the appropriate quantity, quality, composition, and cost. And that is what Theme 3 is all about. And that speaks to a strategic goal to ensure those elements of quantity, quality, cost, to ensure we achieve the Department of Defense mandate and its mission. Objective number one speaks to the quality element, quantity element, and objective two speaks to the quality element, the composition is objective three, and then obviously the cost associated to the numbers and the quality and the quantity of people.
You're saying objective number one is quantity or quality?
Quantity.
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 But yeah.
Quality, sorry, sir. Quality. The quality is the quality of the people in terms of the profile, and objective two is quality.
Objective number one is quality.
Quality, correct.
Two would be quantity.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Sir, related to objective number one are 22 tasks that we need to do. And we don't have time to go in each and every task, but right at the back of the presentation and the handout, the 22 tasks are mentioned. Then in terms of the 25 tasks, in terms of the composition of the force, 27 tasks and 5 tasks around cost and expenditure. Chairperson, so the two overriding strategic documents that give functionality to the HR function is therefore the duty overarching HR strategy and its charter, also known as cradle to grave concept. In village end states, in terms of these two important documents, is human resources of the appropriate quality, quantity, composition, and cost, how we manage our human resources and the excellent way and an accountable way, and obviously the HR development system of our people and how we train them is cardinal and is coordinated through proper learning pathways. Chairperson, the next slide shows the high-level value chain, the DOD HR value chain of the HR charter to ensure that the strategy is properly implemented. Now, right in the middle of this diagram, we see that you need to give proper HR strategic direction and policy advice for the HR component of the department as a whole. As you do that, in the blue in the middle is human resource management. And human resource management speaks to, from HR acquisition, how you maintain your people, how you career management them, how you separate them, and even the aspect of ceremonial aspects are embedded in that little bubble in the middle. And as you manage your people, any defense force need to grow its own timber through the development of its people, and therefore the HR development cannot be overestimated. It's a very important function. And transversely embedded in all these processes are the transformation aspects that oversee these processes. On the outside, we have three functional bubbles. There's physical training and sport, which is also the domain of General Ngeni, occupational health and safety, and the training command that execute the HR development. But whatever you do in the middle of this value chain, Honorable Chairperson, you need a few support elements at the back. The first yellow part at the back on the slide is your HR policies and processes that direct these processes. We have a myriad of HR policies and processes. You cannot do HR in a proper way if you don't have proper HR technology, your IT system that speaks to each and every process that you run in the HR environment, from bringing in people up to the point where you take them out of the system. You need HR functionaries, commanders, and line management that must understand the role that they need to play in the HR function, because you find HR people in each and every corner unit based in the Defense Force, and that's the role of HR functionaries, commanders, line managers, to make sure that they execute proper HR management. Honourable Chair, I will now deal with those priority areas in the 2040 MTEP area that we need to address. I also call them the 10 elephants in the room of the HR division. The first one is the HR budget and how that budget needs to be reduced in terms of the total budget that's been given to the Department of Defense and the HR strength. Currently we sit with a challenge, and I will come later with the shortage in the HR budget, but the demand for more deployments, either internally or externally, is on our doorsteps every day. We need to make sure that we develop our officers in an appropriate way, and the new officers' dispensation is busy unfolding to deal with the new demands of our time. And that is embedded in a new officers' development program from candidate officers right through to the most senior post in the Department of Defense. Chairperson, a very huge task at hand, and I will explain a little bit later more detail on this. We now have 20 years in democracy since 1994, but we need to look forward to see how the new military career model of the HR component need to look like in the future. We need to talk about more decentralized HR acquisition and building the capacity of such an acquisition system within each service. Career management is at the heart of all your transactions that you do from day to day, and the standardization of such a career management system and the processes across all four services is of primary importance. And then also the reskilling and placement for people in a second career as and when they exit and finalize their career in defense. And when you exit them, you need to make sure that you pay them the benefits due within 60 days. Now all these things, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, is not possible if you don't have a proper new generation integrated HR information system, IT system, electronic system that can support this. The current PASOL system, as the PASOL in the rest of government, is a very old system, and we need a new generation IT system that supports all the processes in a proper way. We need a new approach in training our HR officers. Currently, HR officers are trained through our personnel services school. We need a new approach with interlink such approaches to tertiary institutions to have a higher quality and professionalized HR functionaries. And obviously, Chair, whatever we do, its implementation must ensure the Defense Review objectives of excellent and accountable HR management at the end of the day, which is C2, which is a presentation on its own. Honorable Chair, taking those priorities into consideration and referring to the quality of the soldiers and our civilian people, what are those main elements that drive that process, and where do we stand with them since we implemented? First of all, on HR acquisition. We're currently busy with the execution and decentralization of service-specific recruitment, and to make sure that each service will establish at the end of the day a professional HR acquisition capability that's well resourced. Currently, HR acquisition is very heavily centralized at the HR division. The objective here, Honorable Chair, is both the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Military Health Service must have their own capability to make sure that they recruit people by the different course and musterings as required by those services. Obviously, through that process, you need to have appropriate selection criteria and instruments that make sure that the post profiles of those four and mustering are driving the quality of recruitment that we envisage. The infantrymen must be recruited by properly trained infantrymen, likewise armor, etc. And the recruitment should focus on learners in high school and at students in tertiary institutions, and not only grade 12 learners, but already from grade 10 onwards, to find the high quality of material in the recruitment system. And currently, the MSD, Monetary Skills Development System, still is the feature system for both the regulars and the reserves, and that might be replaced in time to come in terms of the new career market. Then, Chairperson, in terms of HR development, as you're bringing the right people through that HR acquisition system, you need to develop them through an integrated approach through education, training, and development opportunities that address both and interlink with the career path and promoting a learning organization. And an effective delivery system for all formal training, including proper infrastructure, need to be in place at all our training institutions. And a lot of activities are underway to just ensure that. And then also a new integrated and professional training model. I refer to officers. That is the first priority. But we don't want to leave our warrant officers, non-commissioned officers, and civilians behind. And at the end of the day, that must support both those organized or entities' career and learning paths. In terms of career management, which is a very important element, we need to make sure that we do proper succession planning, because a military grows its own timber, as I already indicated, Chairperson. And succession planning is at the helm of this process, and we need to make sure that we manage the talents when we do the succession planning of our members accordingly. And that can only be done if we have a proper, standardized career management process that intersects with the career paths of each corps and mustering in the Defence Force, how it's linked to the learning paths, and the post-profiles embedded in the organizational design. This obviously can include the regular updates of individual career plans for each member, and members should know their succession plans well in advance. And the challenge here is to move in future to have 2 years in advance. But we can only have that if you have a proper IT system and a process that helps with this. And then HR separation, when people reach their career plateau in the military, you need to do it in a proactive manner and facilitate a member's exit. By profiling the member's profile, see how we can match with the labor market and see how we can align then some of the opportunities with those demands in the labor market. And career plans, which I addressed in the previous bullet, need to inform those exit stages well in advance so that we can also see a seamless migration when regulars leave for possible service in the reserves at the exit stages. Chairperson, a few statistics. If we look at the Military Skills Development System, and we look at this graph, and we see in blue is our troops, the total troops that we had since 2001. If we can use 2001 as an example, or 2002, we had 17,626 riflemen or troops, privates. Only 1,797, or 9% of them in 2000, were between the age of 18 to 24. That's the ideal age where you want your troops. And then in 2003, we start introducing for the first time the Military Skills Development System. And we can see it improved to 15%. It moved up all the way, and at a height in 2011, at 57%, 12,253 out of the 21,600 troops were between the age of 18 to 24. But unfortunately, due to budget constraints and also smaller MSDS intakes, it moved
down a bit to the 40%
mark. And we really want to see that we can up that again. That's a very important element of the age profile of our troops, which speaks to the quality element. Then, Chair, the attrition rates. What happened with attrition? That's people that leave the department. And here we see the total strength since 2008-9, 74,800 to where we in 13-14, 78,725. And as we can see, there was a downward trend with our exit to where it's in 2013-14, 3,280, which is 4.1%. Now, in terms of labor turnover tendency, they say anything under 10%. right, is only the uniform component. That means the regular force uniform component. It speaks for itself again. The trend there, currently 3.3%, down from 6.7%. Then our civilian employees, there's a bit of an upward trend, and the reason for that is there was a number of low-level civilians that was appointed on contract basis that increased the figure in 30-40, as well as medical interns that left the department, but we can see it's there in the region of 6-8%. If we look at our critical occupations, then we see from 11.4%, and I will speak which are those, is down to 4.3%. Here we see more detail. The scarce skills occupation are those utility people, the air crew, the airspace controllers, the Navy combat officers, the engineers, your technical masters, all your artisans, health professionals, and nurses are embedded in that. And since the improvements in 2008-9, which I will speak a little bit more on later, we saw a downward trend from 1,530 in 89 to 900, and where it was 625 in the 13-14 financial year. Chairperson, if we then can have a look at one of the new objectives in moving forward with the HR overarching HR strategy and its HR charter, is what we call a diagram on the new military career model for the future. This military career model of the future are built on five building blocks. Right in the middle sits the building block number one, where members will come through the system through the entry ranks. Military members cannot be appointed as colonels, generals, warrant officers from the street, as we find them from time to time in the police service, with all respect. Members come through the entry rank as officers, as warrant officers, or as NCOs. And as they come into the entry ranks, they need to move through what we call mobility is determined by means of certain exit stages for each rank based on a member's age and years of rank according to the career path of each corps and master. Meaning if the infantry say, I want my privates between this age, say not older than 28 years of age, and there's no upward mobility, a member must know when he or she entered the military career for the future that there is a gate along this route up to the age of 60. And if you're not successful, then you need to exit at those gates. And that must be informed well in advance. The second pillar that sits around this new career model is the promotion policy of the future. We need to make sure that we have more experienced people by longer periods in rank, that it counters rank inflation. It needs to decrease rank inflation. It needs to enhance experience in the rank and no further mobility when the member reaches the exit stage and there's no further upward mobility. Promotion is driven by individual performance and promotion is linked to proper succession planning. That's why we need that standardized succession plan. Chairperson, honorable members, when you have a system like this, it's totally unique. It's not like the rest of government. You need, therefore, a new salary dispensation that sits around. A salary
dispensation
that is based on a system that supports the career model, that speaks to years of service. If you have a colonel, you might have a deputy director and the rest of the public service with 2 years service. You can't have a colonel with 20 to 25 years service. You grow your own number. And therefore, this proposal must support those exit stages that I displaced and also counter the rank inflation. And therefore, a very important determining factor is years in service for this dispensation. As you do that, the third or the fourth building block is your allowance. Currently we have millions of allowance in the department and we need to see how we're going to rationalize those allowance and fix them so that there's a proper ratio between the fixed pay that I explained in the previous block, and that you pay in terms of allowances. You need to pay those allowances for obviously unique skills, and there must be a proper ratio how you determine that. And the last building block for this career model is the exit mechanism. As we members are informed through the exit stages, and preferably 3 years in advance, you need to make sure that an exit mechanism that's linked to these multiple years in the rank need to take care of this process. It's in support of the up or out principle, Honourable Chair, and it needs to be designed in such a way that its benefits support those concepts of exiting people at different ages and also promote the concept of preservation of such benefits to a member. Such a system can only work if there's a proper performance management system that sits around it. And therefore you need a proper IT system and also a proper regulatory framework in the form of a regulation to support this career model. Chair, that's a few words in terms of the quantity, the quality aspect of our troops, quality. Now, what about quantity? That's the numbers. The post establishment in support of the force design and structure drive those peacetime establishment tables, or you can even call it wartime establishment tables. So we cannot underestimate the role that the force design structure and establishment play in this regard. Then you need a proper feeder system that feeds your establishment for both the reserves and the regulars, and here we foresee a split. You need a unique system for the regulars, you need a unique system for the reserves. And then at the end of the day, you need to develop your people as they come into your education, training and development delivery system must respond to the throughput that you foresee in terms of your success plan. So we see how this new ambitious career model then interlinks also to support your throughput in this process. So here we see the evolution of the full-time component of the department, where shortly after integration in 1996, there was over 100,000 strength, and how it came down and then increased a bit again here from 2008-09 onwards due to our commitments in terms of internal and external deployments, and where we were in 2014 on average 78,714 members, the average strength in that year. So in terms of the HR composition, it's important to have an optimal ratio between your regulars and your reserves, and obviously the rank distribution driven by your post-establishment is the cornerstone for this, and it needs also to support and develop the exit plan when members reach a career plateau in terms of this composition. In a diagram share, the strength at the end of September, we have 61,329 full-time regulars in the system, 21,314 reserves, conventional reserves, the territorial reserves is on the process of phasing out, and then we have also our civilian contingent, just over 12,000 or 12%, and then lastly the military skills development system as the members in the system, 2 year system, 4,230. So what happened in terms of employment equity since 94? 45.7% were white, African 37.5%, and colored 15.7%, that's 1% Indian. That today in 30 September changed the picture to 14% white, majority in reflection of demography, 72% Africans, 13% colored, and the Indian population on 1%. In terms of gender equity, 80% male to 94, 19.8% female. Females increased today in September to close to 30%. And 71% murders. Share in terms of HR costs. Now again here your establishment supported by your force design structure and the whole issue of rank inflation are very important ingredients in determining the HR costs. and it's important to maintain a healthy ratio between your HR budget, your operating and your capital budgets in the SANDF. And the size of the total defense budget is obviously a debate also in the defense review, what will government want to spend in future on the cost. I want to explain this, Chair, by analogy of a water tank. At the top of this water tank, we see an inflow of two pipelines. And if we look full-time component, we see a military pipeline coming into this tank, and there we see our planned inflow. Military steel development, 2,200 per annum, civilian 720, and then ad hoc appointments as people reside 140. But at the bottom of the tank is also a tax where people go out of the system, that's the outflows. On average, that outflow is in a region of 3,000, as you can see the detail of 3,200 was in the slide previously shown. And the actual outflow, for instance, at the end of August for the current year was down to 170. But what we must understand here is if we want to fill this water tank to full capacity, driven by the post-establishment currently approved of the department, it provided for 88,740 full-time regular posts. That will cost us in today's rand in the region of 25 billion rand, including the reserve people of 2.4 million mandates that we utilize in this water tank. We need that type of HR budget. Unfortunately, we don't have that budget. The national treasury ceiling for the HR budget is 23,094 billion. That speaks to an average strength of 78,500. But currently, as we speak, at the end of August, and the department already put plans in place how to make the shortfall in the HR budget of 1,217 million good as at the end of August. Currently, our strength at the end of August was 77,845. But we must understand that the main inflow of our military skills development system, the 2,202 mentioned at the top, comes into January intakes that will take the strength again above the 78,500 mark. But the 23,094 is the current projection on average. And therefore, there we see where we currently, and with the shortfall of the 1,273 million, and the plans is already underway how to make that good. Obviously, the funded strength sits currently at 77,607, and that is where the shortfall comes from. And the difference between the national treasury ceiling and what's on the finance management system is 1.114 million rand. Chair, then the last few slides, we want to focus taking now quantity, quality aspect as well as the composition and cost into consideration. What improvements of conditions of service were implemented since 2009 to help the attrition rates and personnel flow as we see, as we presented. The first one in 2009 was a new salary grading system that was implemented for all ranks from a private to a colonel. That was the element of the improvement. What was the nature of this improvement implemented in 2009? And it was mainly to remove the disparity between salaries of the police service and the military. And that resulted in an increase at the lower levels for privates in the region of close to 37% and up at the colonel level 0.2%. And this new grading system also provides for a 2% interval in terms of notch increases every year, while the general one in the public service is 1.5%. But Chairperson, the price tag for this improvement in today's cost, 1450, is 2.6 billion rand, and that's still at the heart of the shortfall that we experience today. The second improvement of condition was also the defense reserve salary dispensation. The nature of that was a 22% in lieu of increases because they serve on type of contract basis, and the price tag of that was 165 million. The next improvement was the technical allowance. The nature was the technical allowance was implemented for ground force technical personnel in the Army specifically, because previously it was mainly for aviation and naval related technicians, and the price tag 88 million. Then there was the occupation specific dispensation. It's the dispensation that came from more broader government where it was implemented in 2007 across the public service for nursing dispensations, and the price tag 145 million. And then there was the two legal dispensations, first for the military legal practitioners, implemented in July 2007, that upped their salaries, as well as for the civilian personnel, with respectively a price tag of 51 million and 1 million for civilians, because we don't have so many civilian legal practitioners. Shortly on the heels of that one, in April 20, 2008, was the occupation specific dispensation for social workers in the military health service for price tag of 24 million, and then the bigger one, the occupation specific dispensation for medical officers, the dentists, as well as all specialists, 1 July 2009, to get parity with those specialist doctors in the Department of Health with a price tag of 153 million, and then there was the one for the engineers, technicians and technologists, price tag 23 million, and also implemented in 2009. And then there was the allied health workers dispensation in July 2010 with 102 million price tag. And then the last one, Honorable Chair and members, the dispensation that was implemented this year, backdated, where members, if they die in deployments, either internal or external to the country, then they will receive a death benefit for once-off payment of 200,000 rand. And that dispensation is also currently under revision. Chair, in terms of challenges, currently the DoD is facing a shortage of 808 million on next year's HR budget, based on a planned strength of 78,366. Also provided in as the annual improvements of conditions of 5.6% in that budget. The challenge in this regard is, Chair, that there is increased audit commitments of force levels, either internal or external deployments. We are also underway with appropriate exit mechanism, but it's not yet approved, that need to address those elements that reach a career plateau. But the HR budget is currently a huge challenge, and the DoD is fully aware and there is some plans underway to see how we will address that shortly. Chairperson, that in a nutshell is the HR budget, the HR cost, the quality and quantity dimensions in the strategy, and how it unfolds with the improvements of conditions.
Thank you very much, General. Improvement on conditions of service is only based on a life. We don't have any other challenges in terms of conditions of service. Honorable members, over to you.
Let me begin with the comments. Certainly, if the career model as you described is implemented, there's certainly a lot of excitement in that career model. I've just got a couple of questions. What the presentation does not include is the establishment table by rank. Now, if I look at the establishment table by rank as of the 31st of March 2013, one aspect of concern is the fact that the establishment is top-heavy. It looks less like a triangle and more like a mushroom, with 232 generals at the apex of the system and more admirals than ships in the Navy. What is going to be done to reverse that situation, and what proposals are there to reverse that situation in terms of the defense room? That's the first question. The second question is got to do with the 1998 defense review. Why was the recommended option, which was option one, which provided for a full-time component of 22,000 soldiers and a part-time component of 69,400 soldiers, never implemented? Why did the Department of Defense not implement its own policy in terms of the 1998 defense review? That's the second question. The third question, I just take you to slide, I think, number five, which you entitled the defense strategic trajectory. I just want to be sure that I understand the slide correctly. Just wait for... That one. Do I understand correctly that if the defense review is implemented, then in terms of your slide, during milestone one, it will require the defense force to downsize by 27,958 members. That is the sum of 2,136 PSAP members, 7,113 reserve members, and 18,709 regular members. So that would be a total of downsizing of 27,958 personnel over 4 years. I just wanted to confirm, A, that that is correct, B, how the department intends to achieve that. Is it through an exit mechanism or a combination of factors? And at what cost? What is the estimated cost of downsizing by 27,958 over four years? Thank you.
You're done, Honorable Virginia. Any other question? You ask for all of us. General, over to you.
Okay, I'll first give to General Jimmy to answer what she can.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Yeah. The first question, I think it was from yourself. Because you made an observation that in our presentation, in terms of the improvement of conditions of our members, we are only mentioning salaries. Yes, that is true, Chair. We are mentioning salaries because salaries, that is the item 10 budget of the department, is our domain in human resources. But in terms of improvement of conditions, we can go to other areas, but that is not for us as human resources. Because the way the defense is designed and structured, we have the logistical department that deals with facilities. One of the issues of improvement here, we point to facilities. But I think General Gibbet deliberately did not go there because it is not really out of the facilities of the argument, but facilities that we all know do affect the conditions on how our and the morale of our members is taught as well. So to answer you, yes, I think there are other areas where there needs to be improvement other than salary. But unfortunately for us, we are mainly really dealing with what is really our responsibility to say, that is to pay them the salary at the end of the month. Coming to the questions from Mr. Mania, he raised about three questions that I recorded. I don't know if that is the correct what you call it. The first one is the top heaviness on the ranks of generals and admirals within second question was the issue on why the DOD did not implement its own policy since 1998, and most probably the member would mostly explain that, but I didn't get exactly the gist of the question, whether you are referring to members that actually did not go through the integration, because that period was the period when we started the whole integration of the different forces in the defense force. And then the last question was the question on the reduction in strength. How, in fact, it's actually questioning that, how are we going to do this? And then at what cost will that exercise come if we wish to go through that route of reducing the strength that we have currently? I'm not going to say comment on the last question. The question of reduction, really, at this stage, it's a very ironic question, because when you reduce strength, then you are having a contradiction with your commitments. The government commitments for the defense must start have to be where we are needed. The DRC, as you know, the situation in Uganda is now our troops are deployed there. And we've also got our borders to look at as well. And many other government commitments in terms of disaster relief and all those things will come unplanned. And then if you reduce your strength, where are you going to get people to do all these jobs and all these commitments? So the question of reduction has been raised in the defense review sometimes. Raises an ironic question as to whether the question now is to really, if you want to go through the route of reduction and then sacrifice some of the commitments that you mentioned before. So that question also is a question which we need at a certain stage to be addressed. The other question, I think, to give more clarity on your question, I think I'll leave them to my members, mainly Jamal Zibret and Charles Shamai. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I will start with Madam Chair, Honorable Chair. My apology.
No, you are not. You are referring to the chief secretary.
Honorable Chair, as the chief of HR explained, although the writers of the defense review envisage this drop to 47,000 and civilians 10,000, the reality on the ground is currently that in terms of the commitment, that it would be very difficult for the department specifically to go to that reduction. And therefore it will be still a debate that unfolds as we implement the defense review process. For instance, if we want to reduce the civilian contingent with 2,000 people as indicated there, it's a process that needs to go to the bargaining chambers of the public service. And secondly, when we look at the reduction, we must also understand that it will might be a process that needs a bigger government debate of also maybe interdepartmental transfers to other government departments where we can place some people productively in other departments. So it might be a combination of subsidy and interdepartmental transfers as well as exits. In terms of exits, we are at a very early stage to design models in terms of exit models, which is objective in its own, and I think that's too early to speculate on the cost. There's still a huge difference that need to unfold in this regard. That's in terms of slide 5, how to reduce the numbers. Chair, I want to, however, indicate that on the 4, age of cost. As a very important part of the new defense review is a new structure, start with force design and structure, establishment tables that are based on sound organizational design principles that restrain ranking. based on the design principles need to be applied, and I'm quite sure that as part of that process and as part of the new career model, that we will see that end result. Sometimes they've also, in the past, in other countries, they haven't accounted brigadier generals as part of generals, and then inflated when we moved to the rank of brigadier general, the rank structure. I think we have just over 30 major generals and 8 lieutenant generals and then 1 full general. As far as the 98 review is concerned, Chair, I think it's a good question from Mr. Mania, but the fact of the matter is, we must also understand the time when the 98 defense review was written. It was in a time that we didn't envisage the deployments and commitment that we involved today. At that stage, it was understand that internal deployments, border control will be part of the police system, it's backward defense. We see our involvement in peacekeeping operations. And therefore, I foresee a 22,000 regular force as in option 2 of 98, totally inappropriate in terms of what was written in those days. We must also understand that even the current reserve system in South Africa, of the 21,000 reserve members that we deploy on annually, 14,000 of those 21 are mainly people that sit in society which is unemployed. And we must understand that the reserve system will deploy members with other companies, other employers, are not an easy system for South Africa, taking the unemployment and economic realities of South Africa into consideration. And I think that is the type of things that we see in the 2014 defense review that's more realistic by taking up this debate.
Thank you, General. Honorable Sir.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I think the presentation is premised on the assumption that the key to force-defining structure that is discussed by the defense force. Of course, we are privy to that before we put this presentation. And if that is the case, that this is designed accordingly, then I think there needs to be further elaboration given to the question raised by Honorable Mania. Why the sudden reduction in the first milestones to 47,000 from 65,000 of the regular force? Is that to revitalize and to get us out of the system that needs to get out of the system, and then to revitalize and increase it immediately after that to 64,000? So clearly there needs to be motivation in what is in the system and how to get out of the system. The MEMS has been an ongoing nightmare that this department has failed to resolve. And I think it is unacceptable in terms of what is happening currently, that critical posts, critical skills are sacrificed at the altar of a lack of a MEMS. And I think that we need to look at very seriously, that this committee monitors that is executed, that is implemented, so that we can get a force that is really active and fulfill the needs of what is being projected in the defense review. That is on the defense review issue in terms of this, which I don't think the explanation is for sufficient. The other one I would like to raise is the whole issue of HIV/AIDS, which is currently at 23% in the South African defense force. And the unofficial one is 40%. And the huge impact it has actually on an active soldier, and the number of days the soldier is actually absent from service. And the court judgment that was passed in this regard, that those soldiers must not be discriminated against. What are the impacts of that particular area, which is HIV/AIDS? And how does one go ahead with growing this force and also protecting? Otherwise, we're going to have all additional costs attached to it as far as family, the whole burden of disease, that needs to be accommodated, and that will also increase the budget substantially. So I think I would like to have an answer on that one. And then of course, currently we know that the MSDS, everybody's complaining about the MSDS, not sufficient. People are recruited through that system, they introduced the URPP, they got the NYS, and all the numbers have been reduced just because of budget constraints. But then we ask the question, yes, the department complains of budget constraints on one side and not getting enough recruiting to revitalize the system, but the same department refused to implement the MEMS. We cannot have it both ways. And I think the National Treasury Directive, of course, will be reviewed in light of the defense issue. But that has also been pending and suspended for so many years, it's never been implemented. So the department is actually hanging on to a defense review to say, yes, when that comes to materialize, we will then only really review this department.
Thank you, Honorable Sir. Honorable Nadine.
Thank you, Chair. Just back to slide number 5 of the implementation of Milestone 1. My interpretation, and perhaps you could confirm this, is that the Defence Review, in respect of the regulars, are saying that the Defence Force needs to downsize in the first milestone from 65,000 to 47,000, which is approximately 18,000 regular soldiers. Those regular soldiers, the Defence Review consider, in the language that they use, surplus to the needs of the Defence Force. In other words, these would be members of the regular force who are too old, who are incapable of doing their jobs, etc. Now, my question to you is, on your assessment, let's put the Defence Review aside, on your assessment, what are the total number of regulars who are surplus to the needs of the Defence Force? Because of age, incapacity, or whatever factors you might apply. I mean, it is very clear to me that the Defence Force is carrying a large amount of, frankly, dead weight. Much of it, in my view, with respect, General, is at the top of the apex, not at the bottom. So my question, crisply, is, in your assessment, how many members of the regular force are surplus to the needs of the Defence Force on the grounds of age, incapacity, or whatever other factors you might apply?
Chief.
Well,
is the current New Zealand exercise at this stage, of which we do not want to give you uncooked information now in numbers and in the terms are, and which is not really going to help this committee. I do not know my other colleagues what they have to say.
May I just indicate to members that we do have the chief and the secretary have established the team that could look at the implementation of the defense review. And part of that is that we have a work group that is, will look at all HR matters. There is an exception. The general has indicated that the issue of numbers is still under debate as far as you are concerned. However, there is an exception that as you rejuvenate, you will have to access some of the no longer, if you like, deployable soldiers. But how this is going to happen is still a concept that was presented at, before the Secretary of Council, so it's only at a concept stage. And about men, the challenge with men is that before, it was mainly members who were initiating it. And as a result, you would have people just looking at men rather than the organizational needs. Now we are saying the employer should look at the at the needs of the organization, and then it is the employer within this department that should say, I think you should take men, they should make an offer. So it's not a complete refusal, it's more the thinking very strategically about it, so that you don't let people that you need go. You don't reduce the skills that you still need in the department. But I'll ask
Senator that
to
Honourable Chair, I want to assure members that the department, without mentioning figures, I think it will be premature to mention figures, worked very hard in analyzing its HR composition by building a proper computer model. In fact, we determined appreciation through 7 stages. We now busy with stage 6 of the 7 stages of determining how this new exit mechanism might look like, what is the criteria that you apply in doing that. And obviously a very important determining factor would be at the end of the day then the cost which this model will give us. And then also the force design and force structure correctly indicated by the members is the driver at the end of the day for the numbers that you need in HR, because that's the starting point. And with that then visible, and with the work through the 7 stages to determine the HR composition, and what are those extra drivers that you will apply, the design principles, and the criteria, will give us this answer that we're looking for. But it's premature to spoil any numbers now by without going through that appreciation stage. So that's what I had to add to the two previous senior speakers.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Mine was to just a little bit on the NEM. On the NEM has been there for some time, and it has not necessarily yielded the result because it was not members, they were not necessarily selected in a proper way. It was for them to use it as an added benefit. As a result of that, we discovered that those people with scratches, process, those who belong to the critical master level, those are the ones who want to be in the organization, and those are the ones that you need. So what then compounded this was the issue of everyone applying for it. They look for jobs outside and they apply for it and they complain and engage the department. The department does not want to be in terms of the criteria of the men, we need to ensure that the person is rich career plateau. And if the person is rich career plateau and there are no other alternatives, and there's no impact, negative impact on the operations of the organization, it's a healthy impact. And therefore, then the person on the basis will be granted the men. And with the new instruction of the chief, that he wanted slightly to amend the process under which
people they should apply, where they, it would be based on the perception training, proper perception training, where people are going to be identified, and those members will be able then to indicate if they want to take them on those bases. Because also they can look at against the interest of their
And the issue that I wanted to raise was also the issue of when the presentation was made was in terms of the conditions of service. Yes, it was basically focusing on salary, but there are other benefits that is really mentioned. For instance, there was an introduction of the duty pass, which was also extended to some of the soldiers that were not covered. The able soldiers, we have seen most of our soldiers, they were on their way hiking and all of that. So those two different policies were also implemented. And the third state experiment that was also introduced by government has already been made, I think, but in terms of the application of it, it is expanded with the introduction of also additional people who are going to study in terms of the distance learning and our military academy, the intention of us increasing the number of military academies. So those are the things that we have tried to address the benefit long service recognition, for instance. Those are the issues, but we didn't want to mention that because we thought that maybe to focus on those ones that we really thought are very much important and maybe they were already already. In the issue of HIV and AIDS in terms of that is it's a very difficult one too, because the government and how it's been interpreted to HIV is that a person is not sick when it's HIV positive unless it's got a chronic illness and the CD4 count is more than 500. So in that regard, therefore, the FAMDA finds it difficult to say on the basis of that members should be discriminated against because the court made decisions. And the challenge of the FNDF is to try and find the mechanism there. So how do you manage the situation whereby you have a person who's got HIV, who's HIV positive, and does not have a chronic illness, the people count is more than that. However, the FNDF, as part of government, we might cannot see ourselves as different from that because we have to manage the situation. The challenge of that is going to be how you manage it, where are the resources, how do you come up with processes that you are going to be able to say, yes, we are going to comply with this, and what are the restrictions, which areas, which environments are going to be able to say that we can comply with, which environment we see that we can comply. That must also be a study that we are, that is engaging with certain general. They are going to be able to come up with a way forward as to how to treat the situation. So it's a matter that the FNDF is dealing with. HIV, we're not sure whether the 40% is correct, but what we know is the 23%. That's what we know, that is being addressed, and then there's the information from our members. Whatever that is being released should be adequate because most of our members, they attend, if not the random family, they attend the medical. They attend the medical in our home. I just wanted just to maybe to highlight those issues.
As we wrap up the room,
on the issue of the AIDS, why is it? It's because when AIDS advances through its first, second, third stage, the individual is out of work. 420 days. And that is at the expense, of course, of the resource. And then we're looking at the number of people that need to be employed to actually do active service. And I think those issues need to be readdressed and how it's going to be addressed. And if there's been cases like that, what does the defense force actually do in such a case where a person is a third of the year not available for service? And if he comes back or she comes back into service, they cannot actually be the active soldier they are. How does that impact on this whole organization, the structures, and where they put in people? soldiers and wage planning. So those are realities which we didn't hear as being a serious threat to the force design of the defense. And of course, I just to raise the issue of unemployment, there are a number of other countries with unemployment issues, etc. But we know the ratios. Tomorrow we have a presentation of the defense reserves. And the motivation for the defense reserve is that, yes, they come at a cheaper cost, with less allowances, and they can extend the reach of the defense in both internal and external operations. That's tomorrow's presentation. And what I'm hearing here is that the clear discouragement. We are looking at, yes, the regular force compared to the defense force should be, so the reserve force should be 1-4. Or at least, according to the old review, it was 1-3.5. At this moment, we're looking at the other way around, it's 32,000 compared to 80,000. Where it is 1-4, where regulars are much more. So, I just wondered, what is the international trend that is out there? And of course, looking at the real situation in our country, we're seeing this budget constraint. And this is the real situation we face with. We can't squeeze out of this budget more than what it can be. So that comparison, the issue of the aid and the impact with the basic bonds level and attack on the service. Then of course the issue of the capital assets, which was an issue that was raised, that the defense force has not dealt with that specific area. And that area deals particularly with IP, brand, marketing, which is a huge amount of money. And that is an area where you can have a huge income revenue. And yes, maybe it's not the right time to speak about the assets, etc. But that is an area which is totally not yet under the control of the defense, where they know exactly what is happening in that area. So, yes, this is maybe just a response to the other two honorable chair officials. Thank you very much. How about you?
Thank you, Chair. The issue of the capital intangible assets, the department is still limited. We've just promulgated a policy that will assist staff to manage it and to report on it. We are busy with the asset register as it is. So we got that one being taken care of. And then on the comparisons, I'll ask
General Mr. Nye,
on the issue of management of
people. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to say that when we look at aid, we do not look at it with the eye of discrimination. When we look at it, we look are very much aware that there are certain kind of the profile of folks and certain very much that their profile determines the profile of the individual. In any event, that the person is not a chronic illness and take a clinical counsel reduces a member of the defense force, then there is a process that we deal with that we tell the person become sick and then we go sick leave and then we more than that. There are processes that deal with people who are sick. And those processes is a health process that you can also put in place and send us and try to manage. So remember there are members. They also belong to FNDF Communication Fund, and they also belong to our hospital, so we still look after them, though they are there. And in any event, because the FNDF lead system is different, when someone is hospitalized, the main in a unit, therefore that person is not on a sick leave, it's a hospital, and the sick leave does not count. It becomes different because it was hospitalized, because the killer unit appears on the strength. But when the person is released for a longer period, and therefore then the process of incapacity or inhalation process then can kick in. And it will be depending on the situation of an individual, and then when the medical bonding can also take place, and the person may be medical bonded on the basis of that, or on the basis of inhalation. Because they are all treated as members who are sick only when they develop a chronic illness. not necessarily serious, but can be redirected to other environment, then the alternative employment can also be done. So it depends on the individual case, and this is that we're dealing with the individual case. Most of the time, our members might run away and not want to indicate what is happening with them. And we don't know where they are, and as a result of that, we also got a process to social workers and subjects that we follow them up to their home and their path and where they stay with their family to be able to be helpful. So that's how the person deals with different. But we do not have a blanket approach that says if you're HIV positive, you've got this is the process, but you're looking at the individual case. And depending on the requirement, whether we can accommodate or not, because it's a process that is dealt with by ourselves together with the career management. In terms of their reserve spot concept, the other countries are different. The Western countries like America and UK, they have a different system of reserve because they are in constant war. They've been having this reserve system that is in place where they have reserve units and people are working those reserve units. They are working like a regular. They are there permanently. In our instance, we are having people who do not who are job seekers. They want to have work, and we cannot continue utilizing them for 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, and then start and go. The job security is also affecting them. So we need to develop a system that we must make sure that individuals have got job security, and also the SNDF has got an assurance that when we are called upon to call our reserve, then we can get them. We are able to get them, they are employed probably, but they can release them to the SNDF when we need them. So it's not just a situation there where it's an easy situation. Because if you are reserved, you also need them that surety that they will be called, you also need to support your family as such. So that system we need to review it, and we are using the process of reviewing it, trying to check how to make sure that it stands for. Yes, the service is ready to give it, and also the individual has got some kind of job specialization. I just mentioned that they are different. America, they got reserve units. People who are working as a reserve unit, they are permanent. They are ready to work permanently.
Thank you very much. The honorable members, we going forward, we need to put this question of reduction in context, because the matter of reduction of personnel is used randomly to such an extent here. We don't know what it means. We don't know as to whether it talks about the exit, can it talk about age, talks about incapacity. But ourselves as a committee will not be interested as to whether you reduce or you do not reduce. The guiding principle for us will be your constitutional mandate first. Say that if your constitutional mandate is safeguarding the borders, you may not need only 13 companies to do that. You may need more than 13 companies to do that in your operational plan. So the question of reduction at that level, I don't know if it's going to be relevant for us. That's what I want us to think through, honorable members, when we talk of reduction in future. We must put it in that context. General Yegeni, I'm on record calling you Vatican. I'm sure I confused your delegation. And General Yegeni, I just used the name that you used to call you in Northern Ireland. My apologies, General.
No, the apologies are accepted.
Thank you very much. you by sharing.
Thank you. What kind of a man is this? Can I ask?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, doctor. All of the best. And we get here is the expert.
You had to.
Yes, but maybe after I finish my